So if a single cargo ship, carrying tens of thousands of containers, gets wedged sideways in the Suez Canal for, like, 6 days, it doesn't just delay the delivery of your new sneakers.
Oh, not at all. It's way bigger than that.
Right. It sets off this multi-billion-dollar chain reaction of basically invisible contracts. I mean, factories in Germany have to halt production because they don't have parts.
Which then triggers lost income claims.
Exactly. And then the ship owner faces liability lawsuits from the owners of the cargo that just sat there spoiling in the desert sun.
Yeah, and global shipping rates spike.
Which strains supply chain budgets, which leads to corporate bankruptcies, which then, and this is the crazy part, triggers shareholder lawsuits against the boards of directors of those bankrupt companies.
It's a massive domino effect.
It really is. And determining who pays for all of that chaos, like whether global trade actually survives that week or just collapses into total insolvency, well, that depends entirely on a web of highly specific codified promises.
It is the ultimate invisible infrastructure that's literally holding up the modern world. I mean, commercial insurance is the mechanism that allows risk, even planetary scale risk, to be financed and absorbed.
Because without it, nothing happens, right?
Exactly. Without it, nobody builds a skyscraper, nobody launches a satellite, and nobody ships a container across the ocean. Yet, you know, outside of the practitioners who actually write these contracts, almost no one truly understands the plumbing.
But today, we actually have our hands on the blueprint to that exact plumbing. For you listening, we are pulling apart a super fascinating document today called the Indico Almanac, a reference for commercial insurance.
It's such a unique text.
It is. And our mission for this deep dive is to understand the structure of the whole commercial insurance universe by examining how this highly specific text organizes its knowledge. The premise of the almanac is really what drew me in.
Yeah, the framing is brilliant.
Because the authors explicitly state that this isn't, you know, a dry academic textbook meant for a college course. It is written, and they actually use this exact phrase, the way an underwriter or broker would actually think.
It's fluently spoken.
Yes, fluently spoken.
And that fluency is what makes this source so uniquely valuable for us today. I mean, we're looking at a comprehensive guide of 58 chapters covering basically every major commercial line, but it's broken down into 5 very distinct tracks.
Right.
And the authors note that it's concrete enough for new hires entering the industry, but, and this is key, it's precise enough that veterans still use it to find the exact language they're after.
Which, if you think about it, is just wild.
How so?
Well, if you are a veteran software engineer, you aren't usually looking up what a for loop is. Like, you've moved on. You know the basics. But here, a veteran underwriter who has been doing this for 20 years is still referencing foundational language.
That's a great point. It reveals something fundamental about the business of risk. You never really graduate from the basics.
We are definitely going to figure out why that is today. So whether you are a new hire at brokerage, a veteran underwriter looking for contract syntax, or you're just insanely curious about how catastrophic global risk is managed day to day, this almanac provides a literal roadmap.
It maps out the whole ecosystem.
It does. We are going to reverse engineer the logic of this universe for you today. We'll explore the specialized districts, the underground pipes, and the violent market cycles.
But, you know, to build a universe, you have to start with the bedrock.
Exactly. So let's look at what the almanac calls track one.
Right. So track one is labeled insurance foundations. The almanac curates a very specific reading order of 7 chapters here. They estimate it takes about 164 minutes to digest.
Okay. What are the chapters?
The chapters are general liability, excess and umbrella, commercial auto, workers' comp, commercial property, business interruption, and coverage triggers.
Wow. That's a lot of ground to cover.
It is. The text explicitly states that this track contains the commercial casualty and property core, along with the trigger and time element vocabulary that every subsequent chapter in the book just assumes you already know.
I noticed right away that the almanac forces casualty. Mm-hmm. So things like general liability and auto sit right next to property in this foundation.
Yeah, they do.
They're blended together as the absolute bedrock.
Yeah.
But why these specific 7 lines? Like, if I am a software company providing cybersecurity, my biggest risk is a hack.
Right.
Not a fire. Why is commercial property still considered my foundational baseline?
Because ultimately, physical reality is inescapable.
Okay. Unpack that a bit.
Well, no matter how specialized or digital a business becomes, it still operates in the physical world. If you own a business, people can get hurt on your premises or by a product you manufacture.
And that would be general liability.
Exactly. And you have employees who could get injured while working. That's workers' comp. If your business owns vehicles or even just rents them for operations, you need commercial auto. And you have physical assets, whether that's a massive manufacturing plant or just a leased office space full of servers, that's commercial property.
Okay, I'm tracking. What about excess and umbrella?
Because lawsuits can easily exceed your standard limits, you need a safety net. That is your excess and umbrella coverage. The Almanac groups these together because before you can even begin to underwrite, say, a complex cyber attack or a shareholder derivative lawsuit, you have to ensure the building hasn't burned down.
And that a delivery driver hasn't caused a massive highway pileup.
Precisely. These are the universal vulnerabilities shared by, you know, a corner bakery and a trillion-dollar tech giant alike.
That makes total sense. The physical baseline. But within this bedrock, there are two chapters that really caught my eye because they seem much more technical than just a building burning down.
Which one?
I'm talking about business interruption and coverage triggers. Let's start with business interruption. The text mentions that this track gives you the time element vocabulary. I use the word time. I use the word element. But put them together in this context.
Yeah.
What are we actually measuring?
We are measuring the financial cost of a clock ticking.
Ooh, I like that.
Let's walk through a scenario. Imagine a massive, highly specialized microchip factory in Taiwan. A fire breaks out and destroys a critical clean room.
Okay.
The commercial property policy will pay to rebuild the physical structure and replace the machines. But rebuilding a specialized clean room takes, let's say, 6 months.
Which is a long time in tech.
A lifetime. For those 6 months, the factory is totally paralyzed. They aren't producing chips. They aren't generating revenue.
They still have bills.
Exactly. They still have to pay their key engineers so they don't leave for competitors. They still have to pay property taxes, existing debt service, and utilities. They are bleeding millions of dollars a day with zero income.
So the property insurance fixes the building, but the business effectively goes bankrupt waiting for the wet paint to dry.
That is the exact gap business interruption insurance fills. It covers the net income that would have been earned plus the continuing normal operating expenses.
Okay.
But you cannot underwrite or settle that kind of claim without fluently speaking time element vocabulary.
Give me an example of that vocabulary.
Sure. For instance, the Almanac covers the period of restoration. This isn't just some vague concept. It is a fiercely negotiated contractual timeline.
When does it start?
Well, that's the thing. Is it 72 hours after the fire? That 72 hours is called a waiting period, which basically acts like a deductible, but measured in time rather than dollars.
Oh, wow. Never thought about time as a deductible.
Yeah. And when does the period end? It ends when the property should be repaired with reasonable speed and similar quality.
Oh, I can see the lawsuits forming already. Reasonable speed. Like, if the factory owner decides, hey, we're already rebuilding, let's upgrade the machines while we're at it, and that takes an extra 3 months, the insurance company isn't going to pay for those 3 extra months of lost income, right?
He absolutely won't. And that is exactly why a veteran underwriter needs to be intimately familiar with this foundational text. If you are underwriting a $500 million limit on a microchip plant, just a slight misinterpretation of the waiting period or the period of restoration could swing the carrier's exposure by tens of millions of dollars.
That's incredible.
The loss of time is often vastly more expensive to the carrier than the loss of the physical building itself.
Wait, hold on. This brings up something I really want to challenge.
Go for it.
The Almanac says this book is for new hires, but also precise enough for veterans. If these are veterans dealing with $50 million policies, they already know what a claim is. They know what business interruption is.
Right.
So why are they looking at a chapter on coverage triggers? Shouldn't that just be pure muscle memory by year 10 of their career?
You would think so, but the complexity of how claims manifest over time makes muscle memory actually quite dangerous.
Really?
Yeah. A coverage trigger determines the specific event that forces the insurance policy to actually respond and pay out. Let's break down the two main types covered in the Almanac.
Okay, what are they?
Occurrence and claims made. An occurrence policy covers an incident that happens during the policy period, regardless of when the claim is actually filed.
Okay, so if the fire happens in 2024, the 2024 policy pays, even if the paperwork is filed in 2025.
Exactly. But a claims made policy only covers claims that are filed during the active policy period, regardless of when the actual incident happened, provided it happened after a retroactive date.
I feel like I need a whiteboard. Let's build a timeline.
Sure.
Give me a real-world scenario where a veteran underwriter would get tripped up by this if they aren't careful.
Let's look at a long-tail exposure.
Okay.
Imagine a chemical company that manufactured a widely used industrial solvent back in 1995. In 1995, they had an occurrence policy with Carrier A. Everything seems fine.
Sounds normal so far.
The policy expires. They move to Carrier B in 1996, Carrier C in 1997, and so on. Fast forward to the year 2020. A massive class action lawsuit is filed against the chemical company. Hundreds of factory workers claim that prolonged exposure to this solvent caused them to develop severe respiratory diseases.
Oh, wow. And diseases take years to develop. So we basically have a 25-year gap between the company making the solvent and the workers filing the lawsuit.
Precisely. Now, put yourself in the shoes of the veteran claims adjuster or the underwriter looking at the historical policies. Which policy is triggered? The lawsuit was filed in 2020. Did the bodily injury occur in 1995 when the worker first inhaled the fumes?
I see the problem.
Did it occur in 2005 when the disease actually began developing invisibly in their lungs? Or did it occur in 2018 when the worker was officially diagnosed by a doctor?
Wow. I mean, if it's an occurrence policy from 1995, Carrier A is going to argue the injury didn't manifest until 2018, so they shouldn't pay.
Yep.
But Carrier Z from 2018 will argue the exposure happened in 1995, so they shouldn't pay.
And that exact ambiguity leads to decades of litigation between insurance companies. We saw this exact scenario play out with asbestos claims.
Right. Asbestos was a nightmare.
It nearly bankrupted the entire industry. So the Almanac's chapter on coverage triggers isn't just defining the words for a rookie. It provides the precise, codified syntax needed to structure the contract today.
So there are no loopholes.
Exactly. So that when a massive, ambiguous loss happens two decades from now, the intent of the coverage is ironclad. And honestly, it gets even more complicated when you mix layers.
What do you mean by layers?
Well, if a veteran underwriter writes an excess policy, which is a layer of coverage sitting on top of the primary policy, and they accidentally use an occurrence trigger while the underlying primary policy uses a claims made trigger.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you have created a coverage gap that could leave the client exposed for millions or drag the carrier into a massive lawsuit.
So it literally is like writing software code.
It really is.
If a senior software engineer misses a single semicolon in the foundational syntax, the whole application crashes when it gets stressed. The veteran isn't reading the almanac to learn what a trigger is. They are referencing it to ensure their contract syntax is completely flawless.
Exactly. The bedrock isn't a stepping stone you leave behind. It is the ground you stand on every single day. When an underwriting team sits down on a Monday morning, they aren't just looking at the name of a business and guessing a price.
Right.
They are evaluating the time element exposures, matching the coverage triggers across multiple layers of capital, and ensuring the physical vulnerabilities are properly fenced in.
Okay, so we've poured the concrete. We understand the physical risks of the property and casualty world, the ticking clock of business interruption, and the historical timelines of coverage triggers.
The bedrock is laid.
Now we can start building the more complex, modern structures on top of it. In our universe, that brings us to track two, which is specialty and financial lines.
Right. This track is a four-chapter, roughly 88-minute sequence. It's designed specifically for people working with financial lines underwriters and the brokers that place those risks.
What are the chapters here?
The chapters are cyber liability, directors and officers, which is commonly known as D&O professional liability, and finally, terrorism and TRIA.
Okay, so if track one is the physical security of the building, you know, the fire alarms, the wet floor signs, the safety goggles, I look at track two as the advanced invisible defense systems of the corporation.
That's a great analogy.
Track two protects the brains, the data, the leadership, and the reputation of a company from non-physical systemic threats.
And the Almanac draws some incredibly interesting structural commonalities between these specific lines. The text notes that cyber, D&O, and professional liability all share a claims-made structure and a heavy IDP appetite.
Wait, okay. We just discussed the claims-made structure in the bedrock track.
Which is exactly why track one is a mandatory prerequisite.
Makes total sense. But think about what it means to group these risks together based on their structural behavior, rather than just their subject matter.
It changes the perspective entirely.
It really does. Because a cyber hack and a CEO getting sued by shareholders seem like totally different universes.
Right, a hacker in a basement versus a boardroom dispute.
Yeah. Why does sharing a claims-made structure force them into the same specialized district of the Almanac?
Well, with financial lines, the injury isn't a broken arm or a burned down warehouse where you can just take a photograph of the ashes and stamp a date on it.
True.
The injury is financial harm caused by a decision, a professional error, or a data breach. The timeline of cause and effect is blurry. Sometimes it's completely invisible.
Can we look at D&O as an example? Directors and officers' liability?
Sure. Say a company's board of directors makes a controversial acquisition in 2021. It looks great on paper. But by 2024, the acquired company turns out to be a disaster.
Happens all the time.
Right. The stock price plummets by 40%, and the shareholders sue the board, claiming they failed in their fiduciary duty during that 2021 acquisition.
Ah, so the decision was made in 2021, but the financial bleeding and the lawsuit didn't happen until 2024.
Exactly. Now, if D&O was written on an occurrence basis, the carrier who wrote the policy in 2021 would have to defend a lawsuit filed in 2024 based on economics and legal standards from years prior.
And carriers probably hate that.
Carriers hate that kind of chronological uncertainty. So they almost exclusively use claims-made triggers for financial lines. The policy that responds is the one active when the claim is formally made against the directors in 2024.
Ah.
It groups cyber, D&O, and professional liability together because the underwriter for these lines is always trying to price the risk of the unknown past coming back to haunt the present.
That makes a lot of sense. But that brings up the second commonality the Almanac highlights. A heavy IDP appetite. IDP stands for Intelligent Document Processing, right?
Yes, it does.
Why do these specific lines have such a heavy appetite for document processing compared to, say, commercial auto?
Well, if you are underwriting a fleet of delivery trucks for commercial auto, the data is highly structured. You can look at a spreadsheet of VIN numbers, driver ages, safety records, and past claims.
Right, it's very neat and organized.
You can feed that into an algorithm and generate a price fairly easily. But how do you underwrite the competence and culture of a board of directors?
You can't put that in a spreadsheet. You'd basically have to read their minds.
And the closest thing to reading their minds is reading their corporate governance. Underwriting D&O, cyber, or professional liability requires consuming massive amounts of unstructured data.
Like what kind of data?
The underwriter is analyzing board meeting minutes, complex financial disclosures, employee handbooks, detailed IT security audits, and sometimes thousands of pages of corporate emails. The risk is buried in the text, in the tone of the communications, in the subtle changes to the employee severance policies. It requires heavy intelligent document processing because the underwriter is essentially doing qualitative corporate espionage to figure out if the leadership is reckless.
That is absolutely fascinating. The underwriter isn't looking at blueprints of a factory. They are looking at the blueprints of the corporate mind.
That's a great way to put it.
But then we get to the fourth chapter in this track, which seems like an outlier at first glance. Chapter 24, Terrorism and TRIA. A terrorist attack is highly physical. It's not a boardroom dispute or a cyber breach. Why is it sitting here in the complex layer?
Because the Almanac highlights terrorism and TRIA as the line where federal policy and private capacity meet most directly. It sits in the complex layer because we are talking about a scale of risk that almost defies mathematics and traditional underwriting models.
Let's unpack TRIA. Because if I am an insurance carrier, my entire business model is based on probability. I look at historical data to figure out the likelihood of a hurricane hitting Florida or a fire starting in a restaurant kitchen.
Right.
How do I possibly calculate the probability of a targeted catastrophic terrorist attack on a skyscraper in Manhattan?
The stark reality is you can't, not entirely. TRIA stands for the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act. To understand why it exists, you really have to look at the historical context of September 11th.
Okay, let's go back to pre-9/11.
Before 9/11, terrorism coverage was generally just included in standard commercial property policies for free. It wasn't explicitly excluded because carriers largely didn't view it as a probable catastrophic risk on U.S. soil.
The math just didn't account for it.
It didn't.
Then 9/11 happens, and the physical, financial, and human loss is beyond anything the industry had ever modeled.
It was unprecedented. The insurance industry ultimately paid out tens of billions of dollars across property, life, workers' comp, and aviation lines. Carriers survived, but they had a collective realization.
Which was?
The scale of a systemic terrorist attack using modern methods was simply too massive for private capital to absorb. The carriers looked at their balance sheets and realized that another event of that magnitude, or worse, would render the entire global insurance industry insolvent.
They would all go bankrupt.
Exactly. So as those pre-9/11 policies expired, carriers began universally excluding terrorism from all commercial policies. They flat out refused to write the coverage.
Which, I imagine, creates a massive economic crisis.
Yeah.
Because if I want to build a billion-dollar stadium or a massive office complex, I need a loan from a bank.
And banks don't like uninsured risks.
Exactly. The bank is not going to lend me $1 billion if I can't insure the asset against all perils, including terrorism. So if the carriers refuse to insure it, the banks refuse to lend, and the construction of the city just stops completely.
It would have effectively halted commercial real estate development and major economic expansion across the entire United States. The federal government realized this was an existential threat to the economy, so Congress passed TRIAO as a federal backstop.
Okay, how does TRIA actually work?
TRIA is a mechanism where the federal government agrees to share the risk of a certified act of terrorism. Private carriers are required by law to offer terrorism coverage to their commercial policyholders.
But they don't hold all the risk.
No. If a certified attack happens and the industry-wide losses cross a massive financial threshold, the federal government steps in to cover a significant percentage of the excess losses.
Wow. It's an incredible admission about the limits of capitalism. Mm-hmm. When the Almanac puts terrorism and TRIA in Track 2 alongside cyber and D&O, it is showing us the absolute bleeding edge of risk.
It really is.
These are the lines where the data is murky, the potential for catastrophic financial loss is astronomical, and in the case of terrorism, the risk is so immense that the private sector literally has to hold hands with the federal government just to keep the lights on.
It is the absolute pinnacle of the complex layer. But, you know, this entire discussion raises a much deeper structural question.
It's like that.
We have talked about factories burning down, massive asbestos lawsuits, cyber attacks, and terrorism. Where does the actual money come from?
Yeah, that's the big question.
When a carrier has to write a check for $1 billion, who is holding that financial weight?
Which takes us out of the specialized districts and forces us to look under the street level. We are descending into Track 3, market plumbing.
This is where it gets really interesting. Track 3 is a 6-chapter, 148-minute deep dive that sits underneath every placement.
What are the chapters covering the plumbing?
They cover market roles and distribution, Lloyd's and the London market, MGAs and delegated authority, reinsurance fundamentals, the insurance cycle, and carrier tiers. This track is designed for anyone navigating the global flow of capital.
Calling it market plumbing is such a vivid way to frame it. I mean, mm-hmm. When you turn on the faucet in your kitchen, water just flows out. You don't pause to think about the reservoir 50 miles away, the treatment plant, the network of pressurized underground pipes, or the release valves that keep the whole system from exploding. When a business buys a commercial policy, they sign a contract and get a piece of paper. They don't see the massive, invisible mechanisms of risk transfer happening behind the walls.
It perfectly captures the difference between the what and the how. Tracks 1 and 2 define the what is the risk we're trying to cover. Track 3 defines the how does the industry actually finance, distribute, and survive taking on that risk.
Okay, let's trace the pipes. I see there's a dedicated chapter for Lloyd's and the London market, and it is completely separated from general distribution. This trips people up all the time.
It's a huge point of confusion.
The first, what is the difference between the U.S. market and the London market? And second, what is the difference between Lloyd's and the broader London market?
These are vital distinctions. The U.S. commercial insurance market is massive, highly regulated on a strict state-by-state basis, and it generally excels at standard, predictable, admitted lines of business.
Think of your large regional carriers writing Main Street business.
Exactly. Standard auto fleets, predictable property risks. But when a risk is too big, too weird, or too concentrated, it often leaves the U.S. admitted market and travels through the pipes to London.
So London is for the weird stuff.
Yes. The London market is the historical, undisputed center of global specialty insurance. It thrives on complex, bespoke, international risks.
Like what?
If you are insuring a fleet of commercial satellites, an offshore deep water oil rig, or, say, an experimental renewable energy facility, that risk is likely being placed in London.
So London is where you go when the standard models break down and the U.S. carriers pass. But what about Lloyd's? I hear Lloyd's of London referenced constantly, usually in movies when someone insures a famous painting or singer's vocal cords. Is Lloyd's just a giant insurance company?
No, and that is the single most common misconception even among some junior insurance professionals. Lloyd's of London is not an insurance company.
And what is it?
It is a marketplace. Think of it like the New York Stock Exchange or even just a local farmer's market.
Yeah.
You don't buy tomatoes from the farmer's market. You buy them from the individual farmers who have set up stalls at the market.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Lloyd's is a physical and legal marketplace where multiple financial backers, which are called syndicates, come together to pool their capital and accept risk.
Okay, paint me a picture of how this actually works.
Mm.
Let's say I am a broker and I need to insure a brand new multi-billion dollar suspension bridge in an earthquake zone.
Mm.
I can't just email support at alloyds.com.
Mm.
What is the actual mechanism?
You literally walk into the Lloyd's building on Lime Street in London.
Wait, like physically walk in?
Physically. You go onto the underwriting floor, which is a massive room filled with desks called boxes. At each box sits an underwriter representing a different syndicate. You, the broker, are carrying a slip of paper detailing the risk of this suspension bridge.
Okay, I'm at a box.
You walk up to an underwriter who specializes in infrastructure. You negotiate the terms, the pricing, the deductibles face-to-face. That underwriter might look at it and say, I like this risk, but it's too big for my syndicate alone. I will take 10% of the risk. And then they physically stamp your slip.
So I only have 10% of my bridge insured. Now I have to go shopping for the rest.
Exactly. You walk to the next box, pitch the risk again, and maybe Syndicate B takes 15%, Syndicate C takes 5%. You walk the floor, gathering subscriptions until you have 100% of the bridge covered. That is the Lloyd's subscription market in action.
That is incredibly old school, but so cool.
It's very relationship driven. Now, to answer your second question, the London market as a whole includes Lloyd's, but it also includes massive standard corporate insurance companies that operate physically in London but are outside of the Lloyd's syndicate structure.
Oh, okay.
The Almanac separates this out into its own chapter because doing business in London, navigating syndicates, managing agents, and the unique regulatory oversight of the Lloyd's Corporation requires a completely different understanding of the plumbing than placing a policy with a standard carrier in Ohio.
That visual of walking box to box is incredible. It's so manual. Speaking of different ways to distribute risk, Track 3 also covers MGAs and delegated authority. What is an MGA and how does it fit into the plumbing?
MGA stands for Managing General Agent. To understand an MGA, you have to understand the concept of delegated authority.
Okay.
Imagine you are a massive tier one global insurance carrier. You have billions of dollars in capital sitting in the bank waiting to be deployed, but you don't necessarily have the niche on the ground expertise to underwrite highly specialized risks.
Give me an example of a specialized risk.
Say specialized medical spas in the Pacific Northwest or boutique wineries in California. Instead of spending millions to hire a whole new internal team of specialists just for that, you find an MGA.
Let me guess. The MGA knows the wineries inside and out, but they don't have the billions in capital.
Precisely. An MGA is a specialized agency that acts exactly like an underwriter, but they don't carry the financial risk themselves. The massive carrier delegates authority to the MGA.
So they essentially rent out the carrier's balance sheet.
Exactly. The carrier essentially says, here is a block of our capital, and here is a strict set of underwriting guidelines. Go underwrite, price, and bind policies for these wineries on our behalf.
So the carrier is the wallet, providing the financial backing, and the MGA is the brain, providing the specialized underwriting expertise and the local distribution network.
That is a perfect way to summarize it. It allows capital to efficiently find highly specialized risk without the primary carrier having to build out massive new infrastructures. It's a vital valve in the distribution plumbing.
But even with syndicates pooling risk and massive carriers delegating authority to MGAs, there has to be a physical limit to the capital. Which brings us to the most critical pipe in Track 3, the one that keeps the whole city from flooding, right? Reinsurance fundamentals.
Reinsurance is, simply put, insurance for insurance companies.
The ultimate safety net.
The ultimate global safety net. To understand why it's necessary, look at aggregation of risk. Let's say a primary insurance carrier writes property policies for 10,000 homes and businesses along the coast of Florida.
Okay.
Under normal circumstances, maybe 10 of those catch fire in a year. The carrier easily pays those claims from their premium pool. They're making a profit. But what happens if a Category 5 hurricane makes direct landfall?
All 10,000 properties are damaged or destroyed on the exact same day.
Exactly. The primary carrier would face billions in claims instantly. They would be entirely wiped out. They would go bankrupt and default on their promises to their policyholders.
Which is worst case scenario.
To prevent this catastrophic failure, the primary carrier buys reinsurance. They take a portion of the premiums they collected from those homeowners in Florida, and they cede it. They pass it along to a massive global reinsurer.
Where are these reinsurers located?
Often in places like Zurich, Munich, or Bermuda. In exchange for that premium, the reinsurer agrees to step in and cover the losses if an event pushes the claims above a certain catastrophic threshold.
So when I pay the premium for my small business property policy, I'm not just paying my local carrier. A fraction of my dollar is quietly being piped across the ocean to a massive global reinsurer to make sure the entire system doesn't collapse.
Exactly. What your local property risk is entirely dependent on how the global reinsurance capital backing it up. You cannot be an effective veteran underwriter and ignore reinsurance because the reinsurance treaties dictate the absolute limits of what the primary underwriter is allowed to do.
This sets up a terrifying hypothetical. What happens when the underlying risks from track one, the bedrock physical reality, collide violently with the complex market plumbing of track three?
It gets ugly.
What happens when that category five hurricane actually hits and the pipes are suddenly stressed to their absolute breaking point? Well, you get the exact chain reaction outlined in track four, severity and the hard market.
Track four is where the brilliance of the almanac structure really shines.
Why is that?
It is a crosscut track. It doesn't introduce any new lines of business. Instead, it pulls six chapters we've already studied and forces you to look at them together.
Okay, which chapters?
It brings back excess and umbrella, commercial auto, commercial property, business interruption, reinsurance fundamentals, and introduces the insurance cycle. It's an estimated 142-minute sequence designed specifically for people thinking about the volatile economic realities of the industry.
The Almanac describes this track as the place where casualty severity, property cat, time element exposure, and reinsurance pricing all touch each other and feed into the primary rates customers actually feel.
Yes.
This isn't just theory. This is the domino effect. Let's build a real-world scenario based strictly on these chapters to show how this ecosystem reacts when it is under attack.
Let's run the scenario. We start with a property cat, a property catastrophe. Let's say an unprecedented historic deep freeze hits a massive industrial and logistical hub like the state of Texas.
The power grid fails.
Right. Thousands of commercial facilities, distribution warehouses, and manufacturing plants experience burst pipes and massive water damage. We have instantly triggered the commercial property chapter.
But the dominoes are falling. Because those factories are full of ice, they are shut down. They can't manufacture goods. So immediately, the time element exposure is triggered.
Yes.
We are now hitting the business interruption chapter. The carriers aren't just paying to replace drywall and machinery. They are bleeding cash every single day. Those businesses remain closed, paying out lost income.
The losses are compounding rapidly. Now let's inject casualty severity into the mix.
Okay, how does that happen?
Because of the ice and the complete chaos on the roads, let's say a fleet of commercial delivery trucks, which falls under commercial auto, loses control on a major highway. They cause a massive multi-vehicle pileup involving serious injuries, environmental spills, and fatalities.
No, that's awful.
It is. And juries today are incredibly sympathetic to victims of corporate accidents. They are handing down what the industry calls nuclear verdicts, awards of $50, $100, or $200 million.
So the primary commercial auto limits of maybe $2 million are blown through in 5 seconds in the courtroom, which instantly triggers the next chapter. The excess and umbrella layers.
Now look at the primary carrier's balance sheet. Within a single fiscal quarter, they are taking a historic beating on commercial property, massive ongoing bleeding from business interruption, catastrophic losses in commercial auto, and their umbrella policies are being drained by nuclear verdicts.
They must be panicking.
The primary carriers realize they are approaching insolvency.
They are drowning. So they turn to the plumbing. They reach for the safety net.
Exactly. They pass these massive aggregated losses up the chain to the reinsurers. We are now hitting the reinsurance fundamentals chapter. The global reinsurers, who thought they had modeled this risk accurately, are suddenly forced to write multi-billion dollar checks to cover the catastrophe and the casualty severity simultaneously.
But reinsurers are not charities. They are financial institutions. When their massive pools of capital take a hit, they don't just smile and absorb it, they react.
Which brings us to the final chapter of this crosscut, the insurance cycle. When reinsurers take massive unexpected losses, their capital shrinks.
So what do?
To protect themselves the following year, they restrict their capacity, meaning they offer less coverage, and they drastically raise the rates they charge the primary carriers.
So the safety net just got twice as expensive and half as big.
Exactly. When reinsurance gets expensive and scarce, the primary carriers lose their buffer. To survive, the primary carriers have to change their behavior immediately.
How so?
They become incredibly strict about the risks they take on. They drop unprofitable lines of business, they lower the limits they are willing to offer, and most importantly, they drastically raise the premiums they charge their end customers.
Which results in the dreaded hard market.
A hard market is the painful phase of the insurance cycle. It is characterized by high premiums, strict underwriting guidelines, and reduced capacity.
So it's tough for everybody.
Very. During a hard market, it is incredibly difficult for a business, even a business with a perfect safety record, to buy coverage. And when they do find it, they experience intense sticker shock. A soft market, on the other hand, is the opposite. Lots of capital, loose underwriting, aggressive competition, and cheap premiums.
This scenario really highlights the absolute genius of the Almanac reorganizing these existing chapters. By putting them together in this crosscut, it teaches you to think systematically.
It connects all the dots.
It proves that a line of business does not exist in a vacuum. A veteran underwriter sitting at their desk in Ohio, pricing a commercial auto policy for a local bakery, isn't just looking at the bakery's driving records.
No, they're feeling the macro effects.
Exactly. They're feeling the intense pressure of the reinsurance rates that were spiked by a property catastrophe in Texas 6 months prior, compounded by a nuclear verdict in Florida. It is a highly reactive, interconnected ecosystem. Every drop of rain, every jury verdict ripples through the pipes and ultimately shows up as a rate increase on that local baker's general liability policy.
Understanding the mechanics of that ecosystem has massive commercial value, especially if you are trying to navigate the industry from the outside.
Like who?
If you are a technology vendor, a software company, or a consulting firm trying to sell your services to these giant insurance organizations, you cannot just pitch a product. You have to understand the immense macro pressures they are under.
Which is the perfect organic pivot to Track 5, the business of insurance selling into a carrier.
Track 5 is a 5-chapter sequence, roughly 122 minutes, targeted directly at Indico field teams and partners.
Okay, what do they cover here?
The chapters cover carrier tiers, the insurance tech stack, operational KPIs, buyer personas, and AI in insurance regulation. The Almanac notes that these are the chapters that anchor every discovery, demo, and procurement conversation.
I love the shift in perspective here. Up until now, we've been analyzing external risk. We've been looking outward at the world fires, car crashes, cyber attacks, hurricanes.
Yeah.
Track 5 turns the camera entirely inward. It shifts from analyzing risk to analyzing the carrier as a business entity. But let me challenge the necessity of this.
Sure.
If I'm a tech salesperson and I have built a brilliant piece of software that uses AI to read submission documents twice as fast, why do I need to care about carrier tiers or the hard market we just talked about?
Yeah.
Can't I just show them the software, prove it's faster, and make the sale?
You might think so, but in enterprise insurance sales, that approach fails almost every time. You cannot sell a complex tech stack to a buyer persona if you don't understand the specific operational and financial pressures driving their internal decisions.
Okay, fair point.
Let's start with Chapter 33, carrier tiers. The commercial insurance market is not a monolith. The carrier landscape is highly stratified, and a Tier 1 global carrier operates in a completely different reality than a Tier 4 regional carrier.
Break those tiers down for me. What is the fundamental difference in how they operate?
A Tier 1 carrier is a massive multinational entity. They write complex global risk, often interacting with the London market and major reinsurers. They write billions in premium.
So they have endless resources.
Yes, but structurally they are heavily burdened. They have massive IT budgets, but they are often trapped by legacy mainframe systems built in the 1980s that run core operations and simply cannot be turned off.
The classic tech debt.
Massive tech debt. They have layers upon layers of bureaucracy. Their pain point isn't lack of capital, it's agility and managing the immense friction of their own scale.
Okay, contrast that with a Tier 4 carrier.
A Tier 4 regional carrier might only write standard property and casualty policies within a tight 3-state radius. They write a fraction of the premium of a tier one.
But they're probably faster.
They are highly agile. They know their local brokers and their market intimately, but they don't have massive capital reserves. And they certainly don't have a 50-person internal data science team to custom build software.
So I am pitching that AI document reading tool. Tier 1 carrier is going to demand that it integrates seamlessly with 7 different legacy mainframes and passes a 6-month security audit.
Yep.
The Tier 4 carrier, on the other hand, wants an out-of-the-box solution that they can deploy tomorrow to help their 3 underwriters punch above their weight. If I don't know which tier I'm talking to, my pitch is useless.
Precisely why the Almanac includes it. But to really understand how this software gets bought, we need to dive into the buyer personas and operational KPIs chapters.
Oh, this should be good.
Let's look at a day in the life of the key players inside a carrier on a typical Monday morning. This will show exactly how the tracks we've covered manifest in the daily jobs of the people running the business.
I love this. Let's do a Monday morning breakdown. Walk me through the internal ecosystem. Who is doing what and what are they graded on?
Let's start on the absolute front lines with underwriting ops, the operations and intake team. Their primary operational KPI is speed and accuracy of intake.
Okay, what does their morning look like?
On a Monday morning, their shared inbox is flooded with hundreds of emails from brokers containing new business submissions. These emails have massive attachments, spreadsheets, loss runs, 8-chord forms, narrative descriptions.
It's just a wall of PDFs.
Exactly. Ops is manually pulling this unstructured data out of the emails, keying it into the core system, and triaging the risks so the underwriter can actually look at it. Their ultimate pain point is the friction of manual data entry.
They clear the brush. Next up, the underwriter receives the file.
The underwriter gets the triaged file. Their entire day is spent evaluating the specific risk. If they are underwriting Track 1 policies, they are looking at physical exposures, calculating time element risks, and carefully matching coverage triggers.
And if they are in Track 2?
If they're in Track 2, they are consuming heavy IDP documents to assess the management culture of a board. The underwriter's primary KPI is the loss ratio, making sure they are pricing the risk accurately so the premium they collect covers the future losses they will inevitably pay out.
That's a lot of pressure.
It is. They are also constantly checking the market plumbing to ensure they aren't exceeding the limits dictated by their reinsurance treaties.
They are the decision makers on the ground. What about the leadership above them? The chief underwriting officer, the CUO.
The CUO isn't looking at individual policies or reading a broker's email. The CUO is looking at the entire portfolio from a macro level. Their Monday morning involves looking at aggregate dashboards.
What are they looking for?
They are asking strategic questions. Are we too concentrated in coastal property in Florida? Is our commercial auto casualty severity spiraling out of control because of nuclear verdicts?
So they set the big picture strategy.
They set the appetite. During the hard market cycle we discussed, the CUO is the one sending down the strict mandate to the underwriters. Stop writing new business in these 5 specific states immediately and push for a 15% rate increase on all renewals.
They are steering the massive ship. And then there's the operational leadership, the COO.
Right. The chief operating officer is focused on the insurance tech stack. They are measuring the expense ratio. It costs a tremendous amount of money to run a carrier, salaries, office space, legacy IT maintenance.
They want to cut costs.
They do. The COO is constantly trying to figure out how to process more premium volume with fewer manual expensive touches. The COO is the ultimate buyer for technology solutions that streamline the internal plumbing and remove friction from the ops team.
But the business of insurance is essentially selling a promise.
Right.
Right? Eventually the promise gets called in. What about the claim side of the house?
Over on the claim side, a claims adjuster is starting their Monday by receiving FNL's first notice of loss. A client's building burned down over the weekend or a truck crashed.
So they are dealing with people having the worst day of their lives.
Exactly. The adjuster's job is to investigate the physical incident, read the exact policy wording, heavily referencing the coverage triggers from Track 1, and determine if the claim is legally covered and for exactly how much.
Right.
They are the ones in the field actually applying the time element vocabulary to calculate a business interruption payout while the client is screaming for a check.
High stress. And managing all of them is the VP of claims.
The VP of claims is looking at severity trends across the entire organization. They are managing the reserves, which are the massive pools of money the carrier legally must set aside, to pay future claims.
So they are watching the bank account.
Yes. If property cat events are spiking due to severe weather, or if juries are handing out nuclear verdicts faster than anticipated, the VP of claims is the early warning system. They sound the alarm to the CUO that the loss ratios are deteriorating.
Which triggers the cycle we discussed in Track 4.
Exactly.
That ecosystem breakdown is incredible. It connects every single concept we've talked about to a real human being's desk. And it illustrates perfectly why the Almanac includes Chapter 58, AI and insurance regulation.
It's a huge topic right now.
Because if we look at that entire day in the life, from the ops team triaging data to the underwriter pricing risk to the claims adjuster calculating payouts, artificial intelligence has the potential to revolutionize every single step.
Mm-hmm.
But the Almanac doesn't just have a chapter on the magic of AI. It specifically highlights AI regulation. Why is that so critical for a tech vendor to understand?
It is the biggest trap for outside vendors.
Mm-hmm.
In an industry built entirely on assessing risk, relying on highly specific, codified terminology, and adhering to strict state-by-state laws, the introduction of artificial intelligence presents massive existential regulatory hurdles.
Give me an example of the hurdle.
Well, fundamentally, the business of insurance is about discrimination. And I mean that in the statistical sense. You are discriminating between good risk and bad risk and charging accordingly.
Right.
But you have to do it legally without proxying protected classes like race, religion, or income level, and without utilizing black box algorithms that you cannot clearly explain to a state regulator.
Right. Let's say a state regulator audits an underwriter and asks, why did you deny this specific small business coverage but approve their neighbor?
Yep, that happens.
If a human made the decision, the underwriter can point to the physical property exposure, the lack of a sprinkler system, and their internal reinsurance limits. It's a justifiable, logical path. But if an AI made that decision, and the carrier can't explain how the neural network arrived at the denial because it's a proprietary black box, they're in massive compliance trouble.
Huge trouble. The carrier can face massive fines and lose their license to operate in that state. So if you are a tech partner selling into this space, you can't just pitch the speed and magic of your AI to the COO.
Because they won't buy it if it's a legal liability.
Exactly. You have to deeply understand the regulatory fear that the COO and the CUO are managing every day. You have to prove that your tech stack is transparent, auditable, and respects the bedrock principles and legal frameworks of the industry.
So, to survive in any of these five tracks, whether you are a veteran underwriter assessing a factory fire, a broker negotiating on the floor at Lloyd's, or a tech vendor pitching a tier two carrier, you need to speak the language fluently. You need the exact syntax.
Fluency is everything.
And for that, the Almanac provides the ultimate cheat codes, which brings us to our final section, the reference shelf.
The scale of the reference shelf in the Almanac is staggering. It isn't just a basic glossary slapped at the back of a book to hit a page count.
It's much deeper than that.
It is a highly structured, interconnected database. We are looking at 276 detailed glossary terms, 77 acronyms, 71 forms spanning U.S. standard forms and London market documents, and a topic index of 180 distinct topics clustered across 16 thematic areas.
Wow.
And every single term in the reference shelf links back to the specific chapter where it lives in operational context.
Just to give you listening a taste of the sheer density of this language, I'm going to playfully read some of the alphabet soup from the acronyms cheat sheet. It literally sounds like secure military communication.
Let's hear it.
We have ACORD, COPE, FNOL, NGA, NCCI, OR, SA, SOV, TIV. What does the sheer volume of this reference section tell us about the nature of the industry?
It tells us that commercial insurance relies on a hyper-specific, highly codified language to function because it is ultimately a legal and financial contract ecosystem. A misunderstood word doesn't just cause confusion. It causes multi-million dollar lawsuits.
Let's unpack some of that alphabet soup to show how granular it gets. Let's look at COPE.
Okay.
COPE. What does it stand for?
Construction, Occupancy, Protection, and Exposure. It is the fundamental four-part framework every single property underwriter uses to assess a building.
Okay, break that down for me. Construction.
Construction. Is the building made of wood frame or fire-resistive masonry? Occupancy? Is it being used as a quiet accounting office or a fireworks manufacturing plant?
Huge difference there. What about protection?
Protection. Does it have central station fire alarms and modern sprinkler systems? And exposure? What is sitting next door? Is it next to a calm lake or is it sharing a wall with an oil refinery? If you don't know COPE, you can't write property.
Okay, we talked about FNOL earlier. First notice of loss. The exact moment a claim enters the system and the clock starts ticking. What about NCCI?
NCCI stands for the National Council on Compensation Insurance. This ties back to the workers' comp chapter in Track 1. NCCI is a massive advisory organization that gathers data across the industry and proposes standard rates and experience modifiers for workers' compensation.
Oh, so they are the baseline.
They essentially provide the mathematical baseline for how much it costs to insure different types of employees against workplace injuries.
Got it. And ORSA.
ORSA.
Own Risk Insolvency Assessment. This is an internal, highly confidential regulatory requirement where carriers must assess their own risk management frameworks and ensure they have enough capital to survive severe stress scenarios.
Like the perfect storm we discussed in Track 4.
Exactly. It's the carrier checking its own pulse to prove to regulators it won't go bankrupt.
Okay, let's look at SOV and TIV, because these seem intimately connected. What is an SOV?
SOV is a statement of values. Imagine you are underwriting the Walt Disney Company. They have theme parks, office buildings, server farms, retail stores, and cruise ships all over the world.
A lot of assets.
An SOV is the massive, incredibly detailed spreadsheet that lists every single physical asset the company owns, its exact location, its COPI data, and its replacement cost. It can be thousands of lines long.
And TIV.
TIV is total insured value. It is simply the aggregate sum of the SOV. If you add up the value of every single Disney asset on that spreadsheet, that massive number is the TIV. The underwriter uses the TIV to calculate the maximum possible loss and structure the reinsurance treaties.
So the acronyms are a shorthand for massive amounts of structured data. But then there are the forms. The Almanac catalogs 71 distinct forms, specifically calling out ACORD and ISO forms. What are these and why are there so many?
ACORD forms are the universally recognized, standardized documents used to transmit data between brokers and carriers. When a broker submits a risk to that ops team on Monday morning, they aren't just writing a free form email.
They use specific forms.
They are filling out an ACORD 125 for general applicant info, an ACORD 140 for property data, and so on. ISO forms, on the other hand, are standardized policy language templates created by the insurance services office.
So the industry shares the language.
Instead of every carrier writing a general liability contract from scratch and risking legal loopholes, they use an industry-vetted ISO form.
The existence of 71 standardized forms across the U.S. and London markets proves that you cannot simply wing it in insurance. A single wrong ACORD form, an outdated version of an ISO policy, or a misunderstood acronym on a submission could change the entire nature of a multi-million dollar coverage trigger.
Exactly. I view it like the rule book for the most complex high-stakes board game on earth. The tracks, the five reading orders we just went through, teach you the strategy. They teach you how to think like a player, how to evaluate the board, how to anticipate the brutal swings of the insurance cycle, and how to sell to the other players. But the reference shelf gives you the exact rules of engagement. You cannot execute the strategy if you don't know the precise legal definition of the spaces on the board.
And that explains why the Almanac says it is meant to be read cover to cover for context, but return to for lookup. That veteran underwriter we talked about in Track 1 isn't rereading the strategy of how to be an underwriter. They are opening the reference shelf to make sure the specific ISO form attached to their excess policy perfectly matches the primary coverage trigger so the carrier doesn't get sued in 10 years.
It is a living, breathing reference tool.
It acts as the connective tissue for everything we've discussed today. Let's take a breath and recap the massive journey we just took through this invisible universe.
We covered a lot of ground.
We started at the bedrock Track 1, where we laid the foundation of general liability, commercial property, and the critical time element vocabulary that dictates how businesses survive the ticking clock of physical disasters. We learned why casualty and property sit together as the non-negotiable baseline.
Then we moved up.
We then moved up into the complex layer Track 2, exploring the murky, unstructured data of cyber and management liability, dissecting why they require claims-made triggers, and visiting the extreme edge of risk where federal policy meets private capacity through TRIA.
From there, we went behind the walls into Track 3, exploring the invisible market plumbing. We distinguished the highly regulated U.S. admitted market from the bespoke historical subscription market of Lloyd's of London. We broke down how MGAs act as the brains for carrier capital, and we uncovered the massive reinsurance safety net that prevents the whole system from collapsing.
Then we watched all of it collide in Track 4. We built the perfect storm where a Texas deep freeze and a multi-truck pileup stressed the reinsurance limits, sparking the volatile insurance cycle and punishing the market with rate increases.
The hard market.
And finally, we turned the camera inward on Track 5, analyzing the daily operational KPIs, the legacy tech stacks, the complex buyer personas of the carriers themselves, and the regulatory minefield of AI, all anchored by the massive, highly codified dictionary of the reference shelf.
You, the listener, now have a conceptual framework for how the entire global risk industry thinks, how it categorizes threats, how it distributes capital, and how it protects itself from insolvency. You now have the map.
Which brings us right back to where we started today. The ship stuck in the Suez Canal. If an industry requires an entire architectural track just to understand its own internal plumbing and relies on a dictionary of 276 unique terms and 71 highly specialized forms just to operate day to day, wait, strike that. If it relies on all that just to survive, what does that tell us about the hidden, incredibly fragile complexity holding up the modern global economy? Every skyscraper you walk past, every software company you log into, every delivery truck on the highway, and every single supply chain you rely on to live your life only functions, because this invisible, highly codified web of risk transfer is quietly working in the background. It is a staggeringly complex, incredibly fragile system. But now you know how to read the blueprint.